Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Noah Lewis Holcomb, Jr., counsel for Brian K. Lampley. This case started in 2006 when Mr. Lampley was asked to take a breathalyzer or some kind of a sort of an alcohol testing procedure when one of his co-workers perceived she smelled alcohol on his breath. Mr. Lampley took that test on January 6, 2006. Subsequently, after that, he was suspended on January 9, 2006, and he was terminated for allegedly making a threat to his supervisor, the same one who took him for the alcohol test on January 16, 2006. After certain things with the EEOC, suit was filed on November 27, 2006. A motion for summary judgment was filed by the opposing side, PCI, his employer, and we did not respond to that motion for summary judgment, and that's why we're here today. That summary judgment was motion was granted by the magistrate judge, Paul Cherry, and we're here today because of our appeal because of that, Your Honor. The summary judgment standard says, Rule 56, if the opposing party does not so respond, summary judgment should, if appropriate, and that's the key phrase, be entered against that party. Of course, we could have filed an affidavit in opposing in opposition to that, but the defendant, in its motion for summary judgment and the designation of material facts, had already put in the deposition by my client, which, of course, was under oath. So an affidavit would have been unnecessary and superfluous. Further, in their designation of the record, the opposing... Yes, Your Honor.
Your brief relies substantially on the allegations of the complaint.
That is correct.
But Rule 56E2 says that once a summary judgment motion has been filed, the allegations of the complaint no longer matter. So how can we consider the allegations of your complaint?
We're not asking the court to issue to consider the allegations of the complaint, Your Honor.
The only support for your claim that comparable employees were treated differently is the complaint, because, of course, you introduced no evidence.
Your Honor, the evidence was presented through the motion for summary judgment filed by the opposing side with all of its affidavits. That's clear in the record, and we make reference to that in our brief. The affidavit of Dawn Tall, which was executed roughly a month after my client's deposition, and the supporting documents with Dawn Tall's affidavit, exhibits A through H, I believe is what they are. And so that is in the record. And so when the what we're saying is when the magistrate judge granted the motion for summary judgment, the magistrate judge did not look at the entire record, which was, of course, part of the record because it was submitted by the opposing side. Now, it's curious enough, the opposing side concedes that inasmuch as they have devoted almost all of the argument portion of their brief to questioning whether or not the three employees mentioned in the evidence are in fact comparators and whether or not the employer would have had the right to terminate him anyway because of alleged alcohol abuse. But it's curious to look at that when one looks at the fact that on January the 9th, my client was terminated, but they did not, I'm sorry, was suspended, but they didn't terminate him until January the 16th, which is a whole week later. And after a week of investigation, they terminated him for the alleged threat and not for alcohol abuse. But now at the summary judgment stage, or rather at the appeal stage, now they claim that the real reason was the alcohol. And I'm relying on the fact that they devote most of their argument to alcohol abuse as a valid reason for terminating my client. Are there questions from either of you?
No, please proceed.
Okay. Now, looking at the motion for summary judgment, the motion for summary judgment includes several things that were not pointed out in the defendant's statement of the facts. For example, they indicate that a threat was made. But in their motion for summary judgment, they also include the fact that another employee, James Heiser, made, and I will not use the pejorative language, he invited a supervisor or coworker to engage in fellatio when he was asked to work overtime. He was simply disciplined for refusing to work overtime. In that company, there is a requirement that if overtime is asked, you must work that overtime until an employee comes in to relieve you. The other thing that he said when he was asked to work overtime, that he told his supervisor who was looking at him when he refused, he would bust him in his, again, I won't use the pejorative language, he would bust him in his MFing head. Now, he is a white male. My client is a black male. Further, Art Cadena, it is in the record. It is part of the exhibits that shows that Art Cadena was told to take a company physical on company time. And he made several threatening remarks to the nurse because apparently she was not using the needle enough to find a vein in his arm. She was not careful enough, and she was wiggling it around rather than finding the vein exactly. And he threatened her to the point where she had to call another nurse in there because she felt physically afraid of him. And finally, we have the case of Ron Artest, another white male, who came to work, and this is according to what they put into the record, came to work, clocked out after about 15 minutes and fell asleep in his truck in the parking lot. He later came back about 2 days later and asked that he be given the employee assistance program for alcohol abuse. And he was disciplined only for not coming back to work. Art Cadena was only given a verbal warning when, in fact, the written handbook, the employee handbook, which it in its entirety was admitted as part of the record by the opposing side, states that any threats made to any member of the public at any time on or off company property is not to be tolerated. And so that's why we're saying that my client was treated unfairly and disciplined unfairly because of his race. He's black, and these other three people I've spoke of, Mr. Heiser, Mr. Cadena, and Mr. Artis, are all white males. So we are asking the court to look at the entire record, and this does not require scouring the record, as several opinions have said. We're just asking the district court or the Court of Appeals at this point to look at the entire record to rule in fact that there was there was a genuine issue of tribal fact in this matter, and summary judgment was not appropriate. I will reserve the rest of my time if there are no questions.
Certainly, Mr. Holcomb. Mr. Murphy.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court, Honison Murphy on behalf of Pollution Control Industries of America. First of all, let me clarify something from the record. My client did not terminate the appellant because he had drank alcohol or because of some alcohol abuse with respect to the company's policy. It terminated him because he threatened his supervisor. Specifically, he said that he was going to make his supervisor pay for subjecting him to alcohol testing. Second, the magistrate looked at the entirety of the record in connection with granting the summary judgment in this matter. Now, in a case such as this one, which involves a similarly situated employee, the critical question is whether the employees who engage in similar conduct engage in conduct of comparable seriousness. In other words, whether they violated the same company rule or whether they engaged in conduct of a similar nature. Now, the appellant has identified three comparators, Mr. Heiser, Mr. Cadena, and Mr. Artest. Neither one of these individuals is a proper comparator for multiple reasons. One, none of them reported to the same supervisor. Two, none of the same decision makers were involved with respect to their discipline. Three, not a single one of them was accused of violating the company's workplace violence policy, as was the appellant. Now, with respect to Mr. Heiser was accused of insubordination. He refused to work overtime, and he also made a rude and offensive comment. Now, the appellant has pointed out in his brief that Mr. Heiser also said that he would bust his supervisor in the MF and head. Now, first of all, what the appellant overheard Mr. Heiser say to his supervisor is inadmissible hearsay. As this court has found in the case of Morrow versus Walmart, 152 F3rd 559, that evidence should be excluded and not considered for purposes of summary judgment. Moreover, there are no guarantees of trustworthiness. If the court looks at the record, and specifically page R90 of the record, you will find Mr. Heiser's warning notice. In that warning notice, there is a statement from Mr. Heiser. There's a statement from his supervisor. Both of them are in accord as to what occurred. They both signed the statement. Mr. Heiser even indicated that he agreed with the company's description of what had happened. That statement, bust you in your MF and head, is not contained there. So you have the recipient of the comment and the person who made the comment in accord as to what was said, and it does not comport at all with the appellant's depiction of the event. Furthermore, even if the court were to consider that evidence, There is no evidence whatsoever that the appellant reported that comment to the supervisor, that the appellant reported the comment to the company, that the company was aware of it, or that the supervisor was aware of it. In examining the record, the court has to limit its inquiry to the evidence that the decision makers actually had at their disposal. There's no evidence at all that that statement had been provided to the company. Now, with respect to Mr. Cadena was written up for inappropriate comment because he made rude comments to a nurse during a routine physical. He was uncooperative and clearly did not want to undergo the physical, possibly because he was diabetic. The court looks at the record, and specifically page R86 of the record. The nurse detected sugar in his urine. He responded back that he was aware of his medical condition, but he didn't want to stick himself every day. When she tried to take his blood, it clotted. He then responded that it always does that, and that is why he didn't like his blood to be drawn. This is totally different than threatening a supervisor to make him pay for subjecting him to alcohol testing. Let's take a look at what the appellant did in contrast to Mr. Cadena and Mr. Heiser's conduct. The appellant shows up for work on January 6, 2006. He claims that he was drinking during his lunch break. That's a bit of an understatement. What we know is 5.5 hours after he returned back from work, he tested blood. His blood alcohol content was 0.047. Now, we don't know what it was 5.5 hours before, but it stands to reason it was a lot higher. The evidence in the record is that the alcohol coming from him was overwhelming. He's then taken to the hospital for purposes of being tested for the presence of alcohol. He's taken there by his supervisor and his second-level supervisor. Both of them corroborate the fact that the appellant threatened the supervisor. In addition to that, there was a third-party eyewitness who was present during the entire exchange, and she corroborated that the appellant threatened his supervisor. Thus, the evidence in the record is overwhelming that Mr. Lampley, the appellant, threatened his supervisor and therefore was in violation of the company's workplace violence policy. This is completely different than what Mr. Cadena was accused of doing. He wasn't under suspicion of violating company policy. He hadn't been drinking. He didn't threaten his supervisor. Moreover, the evidence that was provided to the company regarding Mr. Cadena was completely different than the evidence provided to the company regarding Mr. Lampley. The evidence regarding Mr. Cadena came from one source, the nurse who was complaining about his conduct. In contrast, and again, the company was not there when that happened. In contrast, look at Mr. Cadena. You have the company there in the presence of his supervisor, his second-level supervisor, and also a third-party eyewitness who corroborated the event. Now, with respect to the third comparator, Mr. Artest, he was not charged with or investigating for violating the company's workplace violence policy, nor was he charged with or investigated for threatening a supervisor. He was disciplined for an unauthorized absence. He came in at 11 p.m., he left 10 minutes later, and he never came back to work. This is completely different than the conduct that the appellant is accused of doing. So the bottom line is that the appellant has not pointed to a single comparator who was similarly situated in all material respects, who was treated more favorably in the terms and conditions of his employment than he was. As a result, summary judgment should be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Holcomb?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. With respect to the argument regarding whether or not what my client heard is hearsay, hearsay is classically defined as asserting the truth of a matter when the person asserting the truth is not present in court. My client overheard a remark. That's not hearsay. He simply overheard a remark. I will bust you in your MF and head. As far as the comparators are concerned, the employee handbook, looking at the record, page 65, PCI has adopted the following guidelines to deal with intimidation, harassment, or other threats of or actual violence that may occur during the business hours, emphasis added, conduct that threatens, intimidates, or coerces another employee, customer, or member of the public at any time, including off-duty periods, will not be tolerated. That's the record at page 65. We're talking about Mr. Cadena. Mr. Cadena, looking at the company physical on company time, that's the record at page 86-87, she felt physically threatened by Mr. Cadena to the point where her co-workers came to her aid because of his non-cooperation, as counsel calls it. And that's in the record on page 87. And upon being notified of that, PCI in its internal communications agreed that his actions warranted discipline. And he only got a written warning. That's the record at page 88. As far as Mr. Heiser is concerned, Mr. Heiser's words, I don't know how that can be construed any other way. That is as blatant a threat as there could be. I'll bust you in your MF and head. as opposed to what my client states according to their evidence, which said to his, when he said to his supervisor, you will pay for this one. There's nothing in the record that shows that the police were called or that he became belligerent. Simply that remark, which is very nebulous, you will pay for this one. Obviously, we're in court, so to a certain extent, yes, they are paying for it. I have no further questions from the judges. I will take my seat.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.